May it please the court. Jeffrey Bruner went to a movie theater to confront his estranged wife, who was on a date with a football coach. And when he approached his wife, the coach said, "She moved out, pal." He moved in close, and Mr. Bruner stepped back. The coach continued to confront Mr. Bruner while he tried to talk to his wife, and moved in, kept interrupting, threatened to split his throat within 2 hours, told him, "You don't know who the F you're messing with. I don't play these redneck games." And according to the state's brief, when Mr. Bruner saw the coach's right arm move, he perceived that the coach was trying to grab him, and that's when the shot occurred. The standard of review, of course, is facts considered in the light most favorable to giving the instruction. And the Southern District in this case focused on the quantum of evidence necessary to give the instruction. This court most recently in the Smith case called that substantial evidence. And I think that that is one of the most critical points, because so many of the cases out of the courts of appeals have focused on that language, substantial evidence, and I think that's become confusing as to what it means. The Amschler case out of the Eastern District even called it any substantial evidence, which makes no sense if substantial means a quantum of evidence. And so I think this court made clear in the Avery case and some of its other cases that what substantial evidence means is substantive evidence. That word, and I traced it back to the 40s and 50s to a case that it made it very clear that that term means evidence of substance. And that's the way it's used in civil cases, that term as well. So substantial evidence, I would assert, is not a quantum of evidence as much as it is something that puts the matter at issue.
Well, that's what we used to say. I mean, and for quite some period of time, just enough to put the matter in issue.
And that's what this court has done most recently in the lesser included offense cases as well. This court has determined where there is evidence, putting any quantum of evidence, putting a matter at issue, it's a jury question. And this court, through its jurisprudence in Chambers and Weems and Westfall and all of the big self-defense cases in Avery, has said this is a matter for the jury. If there is any evidence, however improbable, it's within the province of the jury to decide it. And the jury has to have that discretion. In this case, self-defense was the defense. The prosecutor said in closing argument, they're arguing that Mr. Bruner was in fear. Instead, he was in anger. The prosecutor was recognizing that fear was the ultimate issue, but the jury wasn't instructed that they could consider self-defense. The jury has to be given the option of considering all of the evidence, and this court has to review that in the light most favorable to any evidence in the case that
presents. And what was the substantive evidence, the substantial evidence here?
Okay, so it's not much, and I absolutely agree to that, but there's enough to get this question to the jury. The difference between this and the Smith case, which is this court's most recent self-defense case, is that the victim in this case was moving toward the defendant, and the defendant expressed fear of him. In the Smith case, where this court found that substantial evidence did not support the giving of a self-defense instruction, even though it was requested, the victim in that case was actually fleeing and actually was hiding behind a dumpster at the point.
Can you just, assuming just for the purposes of my question, that we were to think that was substantial evidence to submit self-defense to the initial shot, there's evidence he continued shooting him and shot at him once he was down. How is there any evidence to support self-defense as to that?
There's any evidence, Your Honor, because it's a jury question.
When you say any evidence, there has to be some evidence of every element that the statute would define as self-defense.
There does.
So what is the evidence that was presented in this case that satisfies every element of the statutory definition of self-defense?
The elements of in the statute are a little different than the elements
well,
that the courts
that, courts right. have. Which do you think is correct? What explain to me why the statute would not control what the elements are of self-defense.
I think the statute controls. The statute says the elements are may use physical force to the extent he reasonably believes such force is necessary. The Court of Appeals was very concerned, and Judge Lynch especially in his dissent was concerned, that for deadly force, the reviewing courts had added elements to that. And I don't know that it affects my argument one way or the other to agree or disagree with Judge Lynch, because I think when the courts talk about your test, such as from Chambers for deadly force, includes a retreat element, and I think that really just encompasses necessity and reasonableness. I think that those are really the two elements from the statute, and I think that the review test of real or apparent necessity to kill or save himself from immediate danger of serious bodily injury or death, reasonable cause for belief, all of those things can be encompassed in those two statutory elements of reasonableness and necessity. So I think what the Chambers test has done over the years has been a way to break those down and analyze whether there is substantial evidence to present that to the jury. Where I think the confusion has come in is with that term substantial evidence, and I think that the test has moved away from the statute. Now, this case is not controlled by the new self-defense statute that took effect in October, but I think it's important to point out that the legislature has pretty much taken the retreat element out of the analysis completely. The new Stand Your Ground statute, and I brought with me, says the person does not have a duty to retreat if the person is in any location such person has a right to be. So the fourth element of that Chambers test, an attempt to do with all within his power consistent with his personal safety to avoid danger and need to take a life, has been interpreted by the courts of appeals and this court to be sort of a retreat element. So I think when we're looking at the facts of this case, and what the Southern District focused most on was, could Jeff have stepped back from that confrontation? At the point where Mr. Moore was advancing upon him and reaching out to grab him, was there strict necessity at that moment, or could he have stepped back away?
Or could he have done something even greater but less than deadly force? I mean, there was no evidence that the victim was armed or had a similar weapon as the defendant did here. Isn't there some type of requirement that the defendant could use some self-defense, albeit not the ultimate self-defense he chose here of using deadly force?
That's certainly a question, Your Honor, and I think it would be a question for the jury to consider whether the victim, when he threatened to slit his throat, may have been perceived to have a weapon. Could Jeff have reasonably thought that was at the point he reached out to grab him because he threatened to slit his throat that he had a weapon at that point?
Well, again, I
what about the fact that he said in the next 2 hours or something like that?
He said within the next 2 hours. All of these are fact questions.
Again,
I think the ultimate question is whether the jury gets to decide it or not.
Counsel, though, but if the jury, you know, if he had killed him with the first shot, I understand your argument. There may be a jury question as to what was necessary. But I'm not hearing anything from you that says why it was reasonably necessary for him to continue shooting him once he was down on the ground.
My argument, Your Honor, is that once there is anything at all that we can point to that injects this issue, this has got to
go. How did you inject an issue as to that? I'm saying I don't hear anything that self-defense doesn't include the first shot, includes what he did. You're saying how was he acting in self-defense considering the whole of his conduct? Even if I may throw a punch and that may be in self-defense, but I don't get to then pull out a gun. Necessarily, I can't say I injected self-defense when I don't provide any evidence that I reasonably felt my life was threatened.
Sure, and why deadly, isn't that deadly situation, force is a separate question.
And why isn't that the question here, not as to the first shot, forget that for a minute, but as to his continued conduct? He kicked him or stomped on him and he shot him again, and I don't hear you injecting any argument that that was still necessary, that he had a gun he was raising, or there was any belief that he was in danger at that point.
But I don't get to decide whether it was necessary, and I don't get to decide whether
But you
it
do
was
have to
reasonable.
Inject it. How did you inject it?
I think that the fact that he expressed that he was in fear of the victim at the point that the victim grabbed for him, and that he was trying to step back off the curb at the time the victim kept advancing. And that's from the state's admission from their brief. That is also from the other eyewitnesses that testified. That is not just from Jeff's testimony.
I think you would admit that if this were a civil case and your client had the burden of proof on the question of self-defense, that he had not raised a jury question, he wouldn't have met the burden in a directed verdict on
that. Oh, if we had the burden of proof, there's no question.
So the question really is less than enough to find that self-defense occurred, but enough to create a question about whether the state has to prove it didn't occur.
Right, because this is a special negative defense. Once it's injected, the state has the burden of proof, which puts it in the same posture as Jackson and Pierce. You know, if you look at the facts of the Pierce case, when that came down, everyone said there's no way a jury could have found that this quantum of drugs was not equal to whatever was 1,000, whatever the, I can't remember the facts. But the court doesn't decide it. The attorneys don't decide it. It's got to go to the jury, and the right to a jury trial has got to mean that no matter how improbable, once that issue is injected, the jury has to be instructed so that they can decide it. I don't know what a jury would find under these facts.
I want to talk just a little bit about immediate danger. The mere possibility that there may be some danger in the future doesn't give rise to the defendant to be able to use deadly force. What was the immediate danger
right.
here?
Right, and the term from the statute is imminent, and I think that's use or imminent use of force by the other. And I think, again, I'm going to point to the fact that he was approaching him and mm-hmm. reaching out to grab him at that moment.
Has to be something that could lead to the belief that he had a weapon or dangerous instrument?
I think the threat was sufficient to inject that. Threats are not sufficient in themselves, given the approach.
The
as well.
Future threat of harm justifies the use of deadly force.
It's going to depend on how you read that use of the term within the next 2 hours, and I think that's a jury question.
Well, I thought whether or not there's substantive evidence, though, is the legal question.
It is, but I think that this court needs to decide if substantive evidence means a quantum of evidence or whether it just means
Let's assume for sake of argument that it means any.
Any. Okay. I think that's what this court said in Avery.
So if it means any, how does that statement satisfy that requirement?
I don't think the statement alone does. I think the statement that I'm going to have your throat slit within 2 hours combined with his approaching and reaching for the defendant is what injects the issue for the jury. After that, the jury's got to decide if that's enough.
Okay. So what if the fact scenario was in 2 hours I'm going to come back with a gun and shoot you?
If the victim had turned and walked away at that point, I don't think I would have much of an argument. But instead, the victim reached for him. My time is up if the court has no
Thank
further
you.
Questions. Thank you.
May it please the court. Defendant here took two loaded guns and an extra magazine to confront his estranged wife at a movie theater on a date with Mr. Moore. Mr. Moore was unarmed, and defendant never recalled Mr. Moore having a weapon. Shortly after confronting them, defendant shot Mr. Moore 6 times and then kicked him in the head and face. And this is the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant. He was not entitled to a self-defense instruction in this case. Now, this court has repeatedly held that there must be 4 elements in order to receive a self-defense instruction. Must be substantial evidence of 4 elements in order for the defendant to receive a self-defense instruction based on deadly force. Those 4 elements correspond to the statute, and in the state's brief, I've laid out how they correspond. So if you look at take 2 elements together here, the real or apparently real necessity to kill to save himself from death or serious physical injury, and the belief that such a necessity to kill is reasonable. Taking those together, here there was no substantial evidence of these elements. What happened is we have the, in the light most favorable to defendant, we have Mr. Moore cursing at defendant and causing him to back up. We have him, his exact threat was, I will have your throat slit in or within 2 hours, depending on which testimony of the defendant you take. Not I will slit your throat, I will have your throat slit. And then defendant said that Mr. Moore got into a fighting stance and then grabbed for him, or he moved his arm, which defendant perceived as a grab. Now, defendant made clear that Mr. Moore did not actually step towards him. He just moved his arm. So we don't even have Mr. Moore stepping towards the defendant at this point. And then we have the defendant saying when Mr. Moore moved his arm, defendant was able to back away. He was able to back away and shoot him 6 times. So we have no evidence here of an immediate future harm. Excuse me, an immediate harm. It's a future harm. It's a threat of having something happen. Someone else will do something to you in or within 2 hours. And we have the defendant here not feeling it necessary that he has to kill himself. He can back away. And that also goes to another element, which is that the defendant did all within his power, consistent with his own safety, to avoid the need to take a life. The defendant's actions here were wholly inconsistent with any attempt to not take a life, and that's evidenced by the fact, the sheer number of times he shot him, the fact that he just backed up and shot him, the fact that the defendant didn't even take out the gun if he was concerned to show the victim the gun. He was able to move away from the victim and still shot him. All this evidence shows that the defendant did nothing consistent with his own safety to avoid taking Mr. Moore's life. And then the last element is an absence of provocation or aggression on the part of the defendant. Here we have the defendant provoking the situation by going to the movie theater. You know, the defendant testified he never intended to kill anyone, he never intended to kill Mr. Moore, but that is irrelevant. If you go somewhere with a concealed weapon intending to provoke a situation, then you're provoking the situation. And defendant himself testified that's why he brought the guns. He knew that this might cause a problem. That's why he brought a gun and concealed it and took it to the movie theater. Opposing counsel has talked about what is substantial evidence and the quantum of proof necessary. And it is a vague term, evidence putting the matter in issue. And so to decide what is substantial evidence, this court has to look at what has been held to be substantial evidence in the past. And we have Smith from 2015, this court's most recent self-defense case, where this court said there was no substantial evidence putting self-defense in issue. And when you look at the facts of Smith, we have the victim who threatened to fight and yelled at and came within inches of the defendant, which is similar to here. We have a victim who neither hit nor exhibited a weapon, which is similar to here. And we have no one seeing the victim with the weapon, which is similar to here. Like Smith, there should be a finding that there's no substantial evidence to warrant a self-defense instruction. And also, if you look at Chambers, and there were two Chambers cases decided by this court. I'm talking about the second Chambers, which was from 1986. I mean, in this case, this court also held there was no substantial evidence to warrant a self-defense instruction. In that case, the defendant had a concealed gun on him, and the defendant started the fight and shot the victim and then pistol-whipped the victim after he was down and taunted him. And this court said, based on this, there's no substantial evidence to warrant giving a self-defense instruction. Cases that the defendant has cited to in his brief where the court has said there should have been a self-defense instruction, and I'm referring to cases such as Avery, Weems, Westfall, the recent Eastern District cases of Whipple and Antler, all those cases, the victim went and sought out the defendant. Here we have a case where the defendant is seeking out the victim. And so I just want to note that that is factually different in all those cases.
Is there any case that really defines substantial evidence? We're sort of going by example as to which category they go in. Mm-hmm. Or do we need to give a definition?
I think this court gave a definition in Avery. It's evidence putting a matter in issue. And, you know, the evidence is varied in cases, and so it's hard, I think, to create a more detailed definition. It's under the facts of each case, did the evidence put the matter in issue? And here it did not.
Why is it? Clearly it would be wrong to say that this is enough evidence to prove that he acted in self-defense. But why is it wrong or unfair to the state to say this is enough? This has raised the question of self-defense so that now the state has to prove he didn't act in self-defense. Why is that unfair or onerous or wrong for the court to do that to the state in a case like this?
It's not. This is a special negative defense. The state has to disprove the self-defense here. And here there was just no evidence to give to the jury on these four elements. There was just no evidence that would allow the jury to find that the defendant acted in self-defense.
Which would put the state in a very good position to argue to the jury that there just isn't any reason to think that that this occurred. And so you meet your burden of proof that it didn't.
But why
is it right that he goes to prison having never made his one defense? No matter how bad it is and unpersuasive it is, he didn't get to make the one defense he thought he had.
Well, this wasn't the one defense he had in this case. But in terms of a general idea, because we don't let the jury make a decision based on facts that aren't in evidence. For example,
But they don't have to find that he acted in self-defense.
Right.
If it's instructed, you have to prove that he didn't. So there's no danger of them finding something the evidence doesn't support.
Well, if there's no evidence of something, we don't let it go to the jury. That's the court's gatekeeping function.
It's your burden. I mean, if there was enough to inject it, then he's entitled to the instruction.
Correct.
And so if you're saying there was enough to inject it but not submit it, you're flipping the burden.
No, I'm not saying that.
Need to clarify that.
I need to clarify that that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there was not enough in this case to inject the issue.
Do you agree with your opposing counsel that the statute that controls what the elements are of self-defense?
I believe that the four-element test corresponds with the statute, so they both control. They're the same. They both require the same things. The four-element test
breaks it out. Why does it take four bullet points instead of two, then? You'll have to help me out with that. It seems like to me it's an add to.
Well, 563031 has more than just two bullet points. I mean, there's also a point where it talks about you're in 563.031.1. It's, you know, when you're allowed to use self-defense, and then it says you're not allowed to unless you can't be the initial aggressor. So that goes to your absence of provocation and aggression. So that's part of the statute, and it's also an element in the test. And similarly with the duty to retreat, it also is an element of the test, and it's in the statute.
Well, would an appropriate instruction track the four-part test or the statutory language going forward?
Well, I think the four-part test is a tool that this court uses when reviewing whether there was sufficient evidence.
It may be an issue of sufficiency, but not a matter of instruction. Would you agree with that?
Yes.
So why can you address again why there's insufficient evidence to inject the issue? Opposing counsel says there was because he said that he thought the arm was coming towards him, and I think there was a flash maybe.
Sure. As a matter of law, a defendant can't use deadly force to repel a simple assault and battery, and there was no evidence that the defendant thought that the victim was armed. The victim didn't move towards the defendant. And so, therefore, there's not evidence here that entitled the defendant to be able to use self-defense to repel from what he thought the victim was trying to do, which was to grab him. That's all he said he thought was happening. And further, when you look at the four elements here, there's just no evidence of him doing anything to retreat. There's no evidence of him doing anything to avoid taking a life. And there must be some evidence of that before the jury gets to decide the defendant acted in self-defense. Your Honors, have no further questions.
Thank you.
I'd like to point out, if I may, that the defendant didn't have to think the victim was going to kill him. He's allowed to use deadly force to repel the threat of imminent serious physical injury. He didn't even have to believe that the victim had a knife. A punch has been held to cause serious physical injury, and there's many cases that say that. This Mr. Moore was 6'5", and a football coach, and Mr. Bruner was much smaller than that. And I think if he thought that he was going to be punched and serious physical injury would result, he would be permitted to use deadly force
in
the circumstances.
I
That's
know.
What the statute says.
Why does it justify anything he does thereafter? Assuming he could have used some stronger force to protect himself from that first punch when he was no longer threatened by a punch? Why did he have a right to continue? Why was self-defense injected into that?
You know, I think, and as Ms. Flaster pointed out, there was another defense in this case, and there was a psychologist that testified about his mental state at that time, and that's something the jury could have considered, certainly, whether it was reasonable for him under those circumstances to continue to act the way he did. You know, there is evidence in the record other than just being reached for. The wife testified that Mr. Bruner backed up countless times, and every time Mr. Moore stepped toward him, Mr. Bruner backed up, and she put her hand on the victim's chest at some point to hold him back. So there is more evidence in the record than just this grab that we've been talking about. Mr. Bruner testified that that Mr. Moore was circling him while he pivoted away. So there is more evidence to support than just this grab that we've been talking about. And I do want to talk again about, I do want to bring up to close about the substantial evidence test. You know, this word has kind of taken on a life of its own. And it's come to mean more, I believe, in some of these later cases than this court intended it to in Avery, which did define substantial evidence as evidence putting a matter in issue. Several cases say substantial evidence just means competent evidence, not incompetent evidence. And it's got to mean that in this context, because otherwise it makes no sense in light of the standard of review. What troubles me about the Southern District opinion in this case is that they seem to view substantial evidence as a quantum. And if the standard review is the facts in the light most favorable to the defendant, it can't ever mean that, because it's the state's burden once that is injected. There can't be a burden that the defense has to get over, or the standard of review makes no sense.
I have a question for you about what I think about as the second standard of review question. Assuming that you're correct, that the evidence supported or put into issue, to use your terms, the issue of self-defense, and that it was error not to give it, then isn't the proper standard of review at that point whether or not the state has demonstrated it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
All right, I lost myself.
Okay, so if the trial, in a criminal case, if the trial judge failed to give the required instruction, there's still a prejudice analysis.
There is.
And so my question is, do you think it was your burden to demonstrate prejudice, or do you think that the burden is on the state to prove that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I think both are correct. I always have
How
a burden to show prejudice,
correct,
and she always has a burden to prove harmless. But there's always going to be prejudice in a case where a special negative defense instruction was not given where it should have been, because at that point it becomes the state's burden. So prejudice.
Well, assume I disagree with you on that.
Okay.
Isn't the general standard of review and the failure to give an appropriate instruction in a criminal case the burden on the state to prove that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
I believe so, yes.
Because aren't there, you're saying that there's just no, I mean, you're saying that if there were six video cameras on this, that you're saying you have to submit it to the jury no matter what. That's your position.
If there is any evidence in the defense favor, in the light most favorable to the defense, then you disregard those six video cameras in deciding whether to give the instruction.
Well, no, I agree with you on that. Okay, so you've given it now.
Yes.
Okay, so let's assume for sake of argument we're at the stage where we agree the judge was wrong. The judge should have given it. That doesn't end the analysis, right? There's still a prejudice analysis. The issue is who has the burden to demonstrate prejudice. It's not... Do you agree with me that there has to be
prejudice. Okay. There has to be prejudice, but I think the prejudice in that situation is always going to be met because the burden is shifted to the state.
Then why is there even a standard of review?
Well, the standard of review is how you view the evidence and analyze
it
initially.
I'm not focused.
I'm missing your point.
Well, the point is, assume that I think that you're correct, that the judge had to give an instruction, there still has to be an analysis of whether or not there was prejudice by the failure to give the instruction. And one party to this case has the burden to demonstrate whether there was prejudice in this case.
I think I'm coming down on the side of presuming prejudice, because otherwise I keep going back to Jackson and Pierce, where you look at these facts and you say, but nobody could find that. But it doesn't matter, because you have to give it to the jury to decide it. We don't get to say, but nobody could find it, because that's your prejudice analysis. Your prejudice analysis is, because there's 6 video cameras, nobody could have found self-defense in this case. And we don't get to do that. So I think I'm coming down to, you're going to have to presume prejudice under this circumstance.
And that the presumption is irrebuttable.
Yes.
Thank you. Case is submitted.